So the topic this week is the Noble Eightfold Path, which is a core teaching of the Buddha. And I like it when the Buddha has my back. So I'm going to start and end with a quote from the Buddha. The one at the beginning is just a short one. And what he said was, "You cannot travel the path until you become the path itself." And we've probably heard comments like that from a lot of spiritual teachers in one version or another. And the thing about Buddhism is that it can seem really complicated sometimes. I mean, we got all these, you know, we got Tibetan, we got Zen, we got Theravadan, you know, and then there's different schools and different lineages and all these different practices. And if you go to Barnes and Noble and look at the books on, it's like, what do I read? How does this work? What's going on? And it can be very esoteric sometimes, seemingly unknowable. But the reality of it is, the Buddha laid out a really clear roadmap. And if you look at the very first teaching that he did, the turning of the wheel, the first turning of the wheel, which he gave to, I think, five guys right after he reached enlightenment, he lays out the Four Noble Truths, which include the Eightfold Path. And he was real clear. He said, this is the heart of the practice. This is the way to liberation. So what I'd like to do first is kind of talk about the nature of how the Eightfold Path is structured before I go through each one individually. But I will mention what each of them are. Now, they're often referred to as, you know, like right view and right intention. And I've heard teachers often say that maybe rather than right, we could use the word appropriate or skillful, because that really kind of fits more what they are. Because when you think of right, there's the duality, right? Right and wrong, and that's not really it. But I'm going to stick with right because, you know, for the sake of the talk, just because that's the way we're most accustomed to it. So, you know, there's right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And the way it works is these eight paths, these eight factors, if you will, are really divided up into three different categories. Some of them have to do with ethics. Three of them do. Ethics, morality. Three of them have to do with wisdom. Or actually, two of them have to do with wisdom. And three of them have to do with concentration. So, and the ethical practice, sila, is often viewed as kind of the foundation of the practice. One of my teachers, Lee Brazington, the way he lays it out is he says, okay, we've got the ethics, sila, we've got concentration, or samadhi, and then we have wisdom, or panya. He said, in order to have wisdom, we need to develop some concentration. Right? But in order to be concentrated, it would be really helpful to live an ethical life. And that kind of makes sense. You know, when we're living out of harmony unethically, it's really hard to be focused. As Lee puts it, if you're out there robbing banks, it's pretty hard, you know, and you wonder if the cops are going to catch you, it's pretty hard to stay concentrated. So, we'll go through these a little bit in each of these categories. And the interesting thing is that even though it's listed as a path, it's not a linear path. It's not like, you know, okay, we did number one, now we do number two, and then when we get through eight, we've graduated and we get the T-shirt or something like that. That's not really how it works. It's not linear. In fact, Lee likes to describe it as like an eight-lane highway. And we move from one lane to another. you know, kind of like the people in L.A., you know. They don't even signal. It's like, oh, that's my exit. Zoom, like that. Well, we don't necessarily do it quite that way. But they all interplay. Okay? Thich Nhat Hanh says that, quote, in Buddhism, precepts, ethics, concentration, and insight or wisdom always go together. It is impossible to speak of one without the other. Practicing the precepts brings about concentration, right? And concentration is needed for insight. Concentration allows us to look deeply, and insight is the fruit of looking deeply. Practicing the precepts helps us be more calm and concentrated and brings more insight and enlightenment, which then makes the practice of the precepts more solid. The three are intertwined. Each helps the other two. All three bring us closer to liberation. It's a threefold training. And the way he describes it is he draws a circle with arrows. So if you can picture a circle and then the arrows going like this. See? So you've got the highway, the eight-lane highway, you've got the arrows. I like to also think of it as maybe like a three-legged stool. You know? Take one of the legs out, we got a problem, don't we? Mm-hmm. See? Take out the concentration out of this, how are you going to get insight and wisdom? Right? Take the ethical practice, the sila out, we've got a problem. And if we take the wisdom out, well, what was the point? You know? Another way of looking at it, which is kind of like a house, like the basement is the foundation, that's the ethical practice with the concentration and then the wisdom. So there's different ways of looking at it, but they all support each other and work together. I think that's the key point that I really want to stress. And we can see how these three factors really support each other. So what we'll do now is we'll start going through the Eightfold Path, and we'll start with the two wisdom factors. Now, I just mentioned that the ethics is really kind of the foundation. So why did the Buddha actually explain the two wisdom factors first? Well, think about it. If we're going to do this practice, we need to know where we're going. I mean, if you decide you're going to get in your car next Thanksgiving and go visit your relatives in Toledo, and you don't turn the GPS on or you don't have any maps, you don't know where you're going, how are you going to get there? So the wisdom is how he starts it. So this is right view, which is also sometimes listed as right understanding. So you see right view or right understanding. So right view is placed first, because it's the eye that guides and directs all the other factors. In the practice of the path, we need the wisdom, the vision, and we need the vision and understanding supplied by right view in order to see the way to travel along the path. So it's placed at the beginning so that before we can actually set foot in the actual practice, we have an understanding of where we're headed. Toledo. I've never been to Toledo. I don't know. Is it worth going there? So we need a correct perspective on what the human condition is. We need to understand that life is impermanent. This is one of the three characteristics of existence, is impermanence. We need to understand that. We need to understand that basic underlying characteristic of this existence is the tendency to have dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness, or as Buddha called it, dukkha, suffering, it's often translated as. You know, this constant desire to have things different than the way they are. We either want something that we don't have, or we're trying to get rid of something that we do have. President-elect. Did I say that out loud? Whoops. And also understand the concept of no self. You know, the fact that nothing exists independent of other phenomena. And we're the same way. You know, I had a Buddhist teacher once who said that the great delusion is that there's I, me, and then there's this world out there. See? So it's really important to have an understanding of this. This is part of right view. The Buddha defines right view as understanding the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are, one, the first truth, the truth of suffering, unsatisfactoriness is pervasive and unavoidable when we're asleep. Two, the truth of the cause of suffering is craving or thirst, referred to in as tanha. You know, we're continually searching for something outside ourselves. The third noble truth is that there is a way out of this. That's the good news. And the Buddha taught that through diligent practice, we can put an end to this craving. And the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path, the way out. So, you know, he stressed this because he didn't want us to practice just out of a sense of devotion. He wanted us to practice understanding that there's a basis for our understanding. He wanted us to practice with having direct experience of these realities about dukkha, about impermanence, about no self. So that's right view. The second one is right intention. This is the other of the two wisdom factors in the Eightfold Path. And right intention is sometimes referred to as right thought, and I've even seen it listed as right resolve. So the factor of right intention follows as sort of the natural consequence of right view. Through right view, we gain an understanding of the nature of existence, right? And this understanding changes our motivation, our purpose in life, our intentions, right? As a result, our minds become shaped by right intentions. Once we have that clear view and we understand, we can really set a clear intention. What do we want to do? So in the analysis of this factor, the Buddha said there are three kinds of right intention. The first one is renunciation. And renunciation is kind of a loaded word, right? A lot of times when we hear it, when we hear the word renunciation, the first thing people say is, get your hands off my stuff, right? But the problem is most of us have too much stuff anyway, right? I mean, when we get a present for our birthday or Christmas, sometimes the first thing we think of is, where am I going to put this stuff? And sometimes we pay money to go down the road and rent a space because we don't have enough room for all our stuff. Some people go through their closets once a year. Margaret's always encouraging me to get rid of stuff. You really need all those t-shirts. I do get rid of them. So the one of them is renunciation. It's letting go. Another one is the intention of non-aversion and loving kindness, you know, having this goodwill, this loving kindness, rather than aversion and ill will. And the third of the right intentions is to generate compassion and non-injury. So letting go, generating loving kindness, and generating compassion. With these kind of intentions, things might work out pretty well, don't you think? What would the world be like if people were willing to let go and generate loving kindness and compassion, rather than clinging and this is mine and I want more and just having aversion and ill will and creating injury? It's quite a difference, right? So when we gain right view, insight into the fact of dukkha, then we become motivated to renounce our attachments, our clinging. We don't feel like we need to suppress the desire for them. They just kind of fall off naturally. And then we start seeing the connection with other people, and this intention to connect with other people just sort of comes naturally. It's not something that's forced. So those are the two wisdom factors. With the next three factors of the Eightfold Path, we move now into the ethical practices, or sila. We learn to translate right view and right intention into action. And this is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. So the first is right speech. And this factor is one of the five precepts. So five precepts simply is non-harming, or don't kill. Don't take things that aren't freely offered. Don't steal. No sexual misconduct. Avoidance of false speech. And avoiding intoxicants. So we're going to deal with four of those in this part of the Eightfold Path. And the first is right speech. Well, right speech has four aspects. If you haven't figured it out, Buddha really liked numbers, and he liked categories and lists and stuff like that. It's the four this and the seventh this and the ten this and the three this, it's great. He's a very organized guy. I think he could have been an accountant or an engineer if the whole teaching thing hadn't worked out very well. So, the four aspects. The first is abstinence from false speech. In other words, lying. And instead making the effort to speak truthfully. The second is abstinence from slanderous speech. Statements intended to divide, create enmity between people. Instead, the follower of the path should always speak words that promote friendship and harmony between people. The third is abstinence from harsh speech. Speech that's angry, bitter, cuts into the hearts of others. And he suggests, rather, a speech that's soft, gentle, affectionate. And the fourth of the aspects is abstinence from idle chatter, gossip. He suggests that when we speak, make it meaningful, significant, purposeful. I mean, when we're on the spiritual path, aren't we on the search for the truth? Well, how does telling lies fit into that? Not very well. So some of us have heard, the four criteria to ask when we're about ready to say something. If we ask ourselves these four questions, we might be doing pretty well. Is it true? Okay, is it true? Is it helpful? Because sometimes something's true, but it may not be helpful. Is it kind? And is it timely? So that's a great sort of inventory. What if we did that every time we open our mouth? I know I would have avoided a lot of having to say I'm sorry later if I'd done that every time. So these can be really helpful. There's a lot of power locked up in the faculty of speech. The tongue, it's a small organ in the body, but it can be used as a weapon. It can do a lot of good, or it can do a lot of harm. The fourth in the Noble Eightfold Path, and the second part of the ethical component, is right action, or right conduct. Sometimes it's referred to. Now here, we just addressed one of the five precepts. Here we're going to catch three of the others. And they have to do with bodily action. So right action, the first one is abstinence from destruction of life. First precept, right? Abstaining from killing other living beings, which includes animals and all other sentient beings. The second is abstinence from taking what is not given. Stealing, cheating, exploiting others, gaining wealth by dishonest or illegal means, which is the second precept. And the third is abstinence from sexual misconduct, the third precept. Illicit types of sexual relations. And, he taught this to monks and nuns initially, but it goes out into the general community in our culture and has a lot of far-reaching consequences. So these were the core aspects of right action. I want to stay aware of the time so I get through all eight, So let's move on to right livelihood. So this is the third of the third of the ethical parts, right? So right livelihood, the Buddha taught his disciples to avoid any occupation or job that caused harm or suffering to other living beings. Any kind of work that leads to one's own interior or inner deterioration as well. Instead, he encouraged his disciples to earn a living in an honest, harmless, and peaceful way. So he laid out five specific occupations to avoid. The first one, dealing in flesh. For example, a butcher. He said, not a good idea. Two, dealing in poisons. Three, dealing in weapons or arms. Four, dealing in slave trade and prostitution. And five, dealing in intoxicants, liquor and drugs and so on. The Buddha also says his followers should avoid deceitfulness, hypocrisy, high-pressure salesmanship, and trickery, any kind of dishonest ways of acquiring means of support. I mean, let's face it, we want to make the world a better place, not make it worse, not create more harm. In today's world, there are so many more options for livelihood than there were in the time of the Buddha. And it can get a little bit more complicated. You know, questions come up like, what about serving in the military? Should I be in the military? You know? So this is something that has to be weighed. Seems like we need a military, right? So, you know, this is just one example of so many difficult decisions. When I first started doing practice many years ago, I had a friend who worked for a company in Phoenix called Intel. And he was an engineer, and he found out that some of the stuff that he was designing was going to go into missile guidance systems. He was a single father of two. Well paid, good benefits. Does he leave? Does he quit his job because he's contributing to something that can guide missiles and blow up people? Difficult decisions sometimes. So these three factors that we just talked about, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, deal with the outer conduct of life. This is how right view and right intention show up in our actions in the outer world. Buddha was a very practical guy. The next three factors fall under working with the training of the mind. So we start with right effort. And the Buddha begins the training of the mind with right effort. He places a lot of stress on this factor because the practice on this path requires work, energy, exertion. Or am I wrong? Has anybody just kind of sat down and all of a sudden the light went on? Because if they have, I want to know what you're doing. I mean, this is a hard practice. It takes a lot of diligence, a lot of perseverance. It's very difficult. The Buddha was not a savior, but he said, the enlightened ones point out the path. You yourself, though, must make the effort. The practice is for the energetic person, not the lazy one. And here it comes to the great optimism of the Buddha. He believed that everybody was capable of reaching enlightenment. We're not hopeless victims of past conditioning. We're not the victims of our genes, our environment, our government. But through mental training, it's possible to raise the mind to the high plateau of wisdom and enlightenment and liberation from suffering. So the Buddha broke it down into four aspects. And if we observe the states that arise in the mind, we see that it falls into two basic classes, wholesome states and unwholesome states. The unwholesome states are the states rooted in defilements, greed, hatred, delusion. The wholesome states consist of the virtuous qualities that we can develop, cultivate. So, the first of these is making the effort to prevent unarisen, unwholesome states from arising. So if there are unwholesome states that are there that haven't arisen yet, how do we keep them where they belong, right? From not arising. So when at a time when the mind is calm, something may happen which will spark off a defilement, an attachment. But if we watch over our senses, we're able to simply take note of what's happening. Notice the object of our awareness. And without reacting. Easier said than done. And I kind of have to skip through these. I can't spend more time on them. We're never going to get through all the factors. The second is the effort to abandon arisen unwholesome states. So if it's already arisen, what do? This is to eliminate these defilements. When we see that a defilement has arisen, like anger, jealousy, and so on, ways to apply energy to that to eliminate it. And this is done by a variety of different methods, but one of them is the loving kindness practice. Some of you heard the story about I was driving down from Weaverville into town one time, and a guy came up on a motorcycle. I used to have a pickup truck with a lot of bumper stickers on there, and they suggested a certain political direction. And this guy came up, and he was reading my bumper stickers, and then he pulled away, and I saw two things. I saw a Confederate flag on the back of his helmet, and a finger pointing upwards, a middle finger. And immediately, I felt a defilement starting to arise. And I did loving kindness for him. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be at ease. I felt compassion for this man. I mean, what a hard way to live. You know, when you create a confrontation like this. I mean, let's face it. He had a bike. I had a truck. You know? And I did. I did loving kindness. May you arrive safely. And I was able to stay calm and keep that defilement from arising. The third one is to develop undeveloped wholesome states. And this is where we can bring beautiful potential qualities up. They're already stored in the mind. They're already there. The capacity's there. But can we bring compassion and loving kindness up? Have that arise out of our mind. You know? And then the fourth, is to strengthen and cultivate the already existing wholesome states. And this comes a lot by just not falling into complacency, but make an effort to sustain the wholesome states that we have, and really to cultivate them to full growth and completion. So this really takes mindfulness, doesn't it? Mindfulness practice, just really paying attention to what's going on. And it's important to maintain a balance. And even though right effort is required, you know, there's the story about the Buddha talked about to one of the disciples about the lute. You know what a lute is? It's like a guitar, I guess, you know? What happens if you tighten the strings too tight? They snap, right? Where's Dan? You play guitar. Have you done that one?
They snap.
Yeah. And what happens if it's too loose, Dan? What happens?
It's out of tune.
It's not going to work, right? So you need to keep that proper tension. And he used that as a metaphor. So we're going to move on to right mindfulness now. So this is the second of the wisdom practices. Or not the wisdom, but the concentration practices. Or samadhi practices, or samadhi factors. So living in right mindfulness is really the bedrock of our welfare, and it's really the foundation of mental development. It's the way we protect ourselves. I know when I get into trouble, I realize I just haven't been paying attention. You know, I've allowed myself to get distracted. I'm just not watching what's going on. But mindfulness is not really developed so easily. Well, the Buddha developed a core practice for mindfulness. And some of you have probably heard of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Sometimes Rania teaches this course here. If if you're, I really recommend that you take and study with her the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. It's a fundamental core practice. The Buddha talked about it in the Satipatthana Sutta. If you want to get a book on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, there's a great book by Joseph Goldstein. It's a big, thick book called Mindfulness. Brilliant. And then if you want to go a little deeper, you can read a book by Nyanaponika Thera called The Heart of the Buddhist Practice. That's a, you know, just really explains it well. But basically, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness are, first of all, mindfulness of body. And there's a whole number of practices that you can do noticing the body. One of them is going to the charnel grounds, which they used to do, and go up and observe where the bodies have been chopped up and left for the vultures. And just understanding that we are of a nature to age, get sick, and die. That's the reality. Two, being mindful of feeling, which is often referred to as vedana. They use the Sanskrit word vedana. But it's, you know, feelings basically have three characteristics. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And sometimes when we do our practice, when we watch thoughts and sensations and feelings arise, I mentioned when I did the guiding how we can label them, note them. We can also see, is it pleasant, is it unpleasant, or neutral? Sensory input, right? The third is being mindful of mind states. Happy, sad, glad, anger, despair, shame, guilt, mind states. And the fourth is being mindful of mental contents, mind objects, or sometimes just referred to as dharmas. And it's mindfulness of phenomena. And there, it consists of a number of things. It consists of the five hindrances, the five aggregates of clinging, the seven factors of enlightenment, the four noble truths, and the six external and six internal sense bases. So there's quite a lot going on. But basically what he's saying is looking at all the phenomena that impact our lives. And it's all laid out in that. So right mindfulness is the basis for the development of the right path in knowledge, wisdom, and contentment. So by doing these practices, we start really getting an understanding about how things work, how our minds work, what our relationship is to our body, to our feelings, to our mind states, to outer phenomena. So right effort and right mindfulness are directed at the eighth factor of the path, which is right concentration. And again, referring to Lee Brazenton, because I've heard him do talks on this several times, he said another way of looking at concentration is indistractability. Indistractability. And this is sometimes defined as one-pointedness of mind or unification of mind. To develop concentration, we generally need to focus on a single object. And the single object that's very typical for many of us is the breath. But I've met practitioners, very good experienced practitioners, that don't use the breath. They use other objects of meditation. So it's just picking an object to really fix the mind on, to train the mind so it can stay there somewhat unwavering. So we use right effort to keep the mind focused on the object, right mindfulness to be aware of the hindrances to concentration, and then we use effort to eliminate the hindrances and strengthen the concentration. And with repeated practice, the mind gets more and more still. Some days. And if you actually go and read in the suttas about guide concentration, the Buddha actually says it's the practice of the jhanas, J-H-A-N-A, the jhanas or meditative absorptions. And that's a practice of deep concentration that is designed to become very focused so that you can do various insight practices, like the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and really get some clarity. But I got to tell you, not many teachers teach the jhanas anymore. And that's a whole story. But Lee Brazington does. So, so yeah, we're on right concentration if you hadn't. I didn't make that really clear. So, yeah, stilled mind is really the gateway to wisdom. You know, when the mind is stilled and collected, that really helps us start getting some clarity on how things are. It's not wavering all over the place. We can really examine the flow of events that happen. We can really see what's arising and passing away in our mind. We can start investigating and seeing, you know, what is the truth? What is the reality? At the peak of this development, we really see the Four Noble Truths directly, experientially. So as the name suggests, the Noble Eightfold Path consists of eight factors. They don't need to be followed in sequence, as I said before. They all work simultaneously. They interact and support each other. They all contribute to liberation of suffering. So, I mentioned before, I'm going to finish with a quote of the Buddha. And this is from a sutta called the Nagara Sutta, in case you're researching. And this one's a little bit longer, but here's what he said. Just this Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the ancient path, the ancient road, traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times. I follow that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of aging and death, direct knowledge of the origination of aging and death, direct knowledge of the sensation of aging and death, direct knowledge of the path leading to the sensation of aging and death. I followed that path. Following it, I came direct knowledge of birth, becoming, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense media, name and form, consciousness, direct knowledge of the origination of consciousness, direct knowledge of the sensation of consciousness, direct knowledge of the path leading to the sensation of consciousness. I followed the path.